And obviously this can stem with distributed agents to intelligent viral infection, DDoS attacks, and inter-segment sniffers. And what I mean by inter-segment is by having two different agents on two different endpoints, both ARP spoofing across the routers, both collecting information and then sorting out which ones have the exact same packets, and putting together a nice network topology that you would normally get from a fully switched environment. The problem with agents, though, is that it can't think outside the box. When you're there doing a network penetration, you've got other risks to worry about. You've got policy. You've got social, political, and economic risks to the corporation that won't maybe not be so intelligible for a program to figure out through looking at files that may be of a proprietary format. So obviously there's a means to an ends in taking this to the electronic level. But we're going to miss a whole hell of a lot from the actual risk in a corporation if somebody's doing laundering or somebody's doing something that possibly may not be seen just through electronic traffic alone, or we would never reach that. We would never reach that solution based on looking at that electronic data alone, and that we would have to be crossing to a level of looking at other documents in the corporation. So now we reach intravenous. The prior slides were just telling along the lines of marrying agents up with TCP/IP. This is a actual live intelligent agent that I'm working on currently. I handed off the Nemesis source code to Jeff Nathan of AdStake because I don't have time to work on it anymore. This is all stuff coming out of my free time. And I'm looking at marrying an intelligent agent up with a host and network, so that we can have network and host-based assertion as far as what we can look at. Hold on. Client-server design. Our agent design criteria for this project, Intravenous, is we've got a munition here, so this is only – I talked to Jennifer Granick for about an hour yesterday or yesterday, Black Hat. And we're using Blowfish internally. I'm not making plugins. I'm not going to scale this down. Because U.S. crypto law is restricting exportation. We're all, hopefully, well, there's a lot of people here from other countries. We're going to do what we can. If somebody else can help write a plugin, that would be great. I want to marry this to OpenBSD, so if we can find some other solutions, that would be great, but I'd like to use the internal Blowfish functions. So we've got a strongly connected, or strongly authenticated, as well as strongly connected, client-server model. What we mean by this is that we authenticate via Blowfish password, and then we have configuration files that are stored at both ends. And we do a SHA-1 hash and a challenge response to verify that the information stored about who the client IP addresses are is sane on both the client and the server. Oh, the script in the slides. We have a sensor, which is modeled after OpenBSD PF, and it's scaled to userland. So we bring this out to stateful packet inspection. We have to take care of TCP fragment handling. We have static filtering rules that are broken up into two categories called intrastate and extrastate. We have an expert system, which has knowledge bases in both the arenas of TCP/IP. So we actually essentially have three minor expert systems rolled into one. The attack and the defensive, or the attack and defense expert systems, because the inference engines provide lookup functions to the knowledge bases, are essentially packet stubs for the, or function stubs for the moment. We're trying to concentrate on next packet injection over raw socket, so we'll be focusing on TCP/IP expert systems. We have an injection engine, these being the three components of Intravenous, which is simply a user-defined injection, and we have some sort of automated injection which is going to be looked at across the expert system to see if we've actually gotten packets. We're trying to do this from the standpoint of allowing or not allowing hackers to be able to dump or craft packets with Nemesis or some other tool to corrupt the state table of interstate traffic, which is the most important state or stateful information that's kept on the wire. Our model sort of looks like this. This is all designed in OpenBSD. This is using DIA. We have packets that come in. We've got the client that connects to a server. The server rules are configured. We've got three systems, the sensors, the injection engine, and the expert system, made up of the knowledge bases and the inference engine. Packets arrive to the packet filter, are brought through the sensor, are checked with the injection table to make sure that the user that connected to the server actually injected this packet. We could kind of care less about the extra state table getting fairly corrupted because we're keeping very minimal state when it comes to extra state information. We'll get to the definitions in just a second. Interstate is the core component of this. It's all you need to be aware of for at this moment. The problem with Nemesis was that we have static injection. That if we launch one particular packet over and over and over again, we are basically simulating a SYN flood. We have a sequence number of 100, an acknowledgement number set to 0. We send that to the target. Target responds with a sequence number of 200, an acknowledgement number of 101, which is the next packet it's expecting to send out. However, Nemesis sends out the same packet again, so we have another SYN that doesn't get answered, and we simply have no handshake. Nobody has really explored the arena of conducting three-way handshakes through raw sockets, so this agent is all about handling this ongoing connection past the three-way handshake for as long as period of time as we can possibly stand the connection up. Through hackers throwing reset floods across the wire to try to drop our connection, the general common chaos that goes on the network wire on a network that is full of maybe untrusted employees, maybe just a public network like here, where you're going to have a lot of people running amok on the wireless LAN, testing out everything that was presented at Black Hat. We have a SYN packet that goes in through intravenous. Same thing, sequence number of 100, acknowledgement number set to 0, target comes back, 200.101. The only difference is because we're interpreting the packet that comes back from the target to intravenous, we can actually have a knowledge base that consists of relative value changes based on a major and minor protocol version, which we'll get to in a little bit, that will discuss how we can perform that next packet injection, which the next packet will answer back from the target. And this keeps this ongoing connection, regardless of payload. Because what we'll come to see is that there are many protocols which are used today, such as 70% of the internet being web traffic, that are simply clear text with like a new line appended. And when you've got clear text, you can just read payload from a file just like you did with Nemesis. And you can have each packet pulling one line per one line of payload, and each packet that goes out does the next packet injection, such as Unicode. Unicode's a great example. You could walk a file system with intravenous, searching for a particular file through a string regex combination. We have a client-server model. IV, intravenous, not to be confused with VI if you're typoing. Change your CSH shell so that it doesn't detect typos. The client has a configuration file called /etc/iv.conf, which contains only the IP addresses of the clients. I say clients here because you may have two foreign powers that want to both join in the same game of playing with packets across the network, and you can set this up beforehand where you have delegated IP addresses, and this is what the SHA-1 hash is computed against. So if a hacker had managed to acquire somehow, you've got to be root to run the client. Well, you've got to be a user to run the client. You've got to be a root to run the actual agent itself because it's doing the raw packet injection. The client just stands up a Blowfish encrypted tunnel to the agent. The agent is the only one doing the packet injection. This is not set up like distributed denial of service where you have actually three hops, where you have a client going to a master and the master's going to the slaves, and the slaves hitting the attack so that when the forensics analysis is done of the slaves, the worst that they could do is point back to the master, which can't point back necessarily to the client unless they do data forensics on the master. So the whole reason that this was set up on a three-tier for distributed denial of service was to maintain anonymity when conducting a denial of service attack. Although this is an offensive tool to explore the defensive applications that could be implemented with AI. This tool is also meant to be installed in OpenBSD, and it's also meant that you have root access on all these agents. So it's assumed that you have control over all the nodes that are attached to this network diagram. So it makes little sense to play the anonymity game when you are not just compromising a host and sending packets over the wire. We initially talked about that this was going to be used with Nemesis, and that we were going to use Nemesis to actually do the injection threads. The problem with that is that I have had some difficulty coordinating LibNet development with Nemesis development. At the beginning, Nemesis was developed just fine because we hadn't reached the endpoints of LibNet of where we're at now. And LibNet has been getting a little airplay these days as far as design on itself. And I spent more time, after talking with Ophir, to get some ICMP obsolete packet types and codes in place, that these were not being produced as a part of LibNet. And so I produced, you know, some more like ICMP search quench. And honestly, I got bored of developing LibNet when Nemesis was the tool I was developing. So I decided to bring this in-house so that we can explore the arena of host-based analysis and what we can do with host-based control if we know the operating system that we're on. The white paper that will be released after this proceeding goes into quite a bit more detail as to why we described or why we are using OpenBSD as a platform as opposed to another operating system. The server is IV Daemon. Which is the agent, and I'm really, really fascinated with KQ. I recently tossed Apache to the wayside and threw up THTTPD on packetninja.net because I noticed that my load was going up to a point where I couldn't use the box anymore that the web server was running on when there were a lot of simultaneous connections. KQ is some remarkable work that came out of FreeBSD and has been brought over to OpenBSD. And so we're going to use that to help create the concurrency in case there were lots of people on different agents coming from different regions that wanted to make multiple simultaneous connections to the server so that it can manage this a lot better. So we have etcivd.conf, which contains the IP addresses of, this should be servers or the agents. It is aware of the actual other agents that are on the network wire because, as you'll see later, we're actually going to do an extra state analysis of the other remote agents that are on the wire. This helps us in being able to see what's going on and what packets are being injected into other agents while we are still connected with yet another agent, which would be considered our local agent. And our max connections are allocated through etcivd.conf so that we maintain some sanity and we don't have lagging connections between packet injections so that it can keep up with the intrastate engine. As you'll see, we've modeled the intrastate engine to use as least clock time or CPU time, I should say, as possible. And this is done through work through OpenBSD PF, through understanding how PF handles TCP fragmented reassembly at minimal cost. And it also has to do with both the client and the agent use IV.conf and IVD.conf. They both have copies of each other, one-way hashes and strong perm checking of the files. We have basically root-owned file 0400. We maintain sanity of IV and IVD by assuming that we are the only ones that have root access to the box, or the ones that do have root access to the box we have knowledge about. So by marrying this to OpenBSD, and being the secure by default paradigm, and the fact that there have been no remote vulnerabilities discovered in the last 4 years publicly. Yeah, Theo and the rest of the core development team. I mostly work on ports, but they have a lot of respect on my end. Authentication successful with password and hash compliance. So we use both these components to do a one- and a two-part authentication. This makes sure that if somehow somebody says, hey, Bob, you know, talking over the phone on AT&T, you know, or whatever, and they're like, here's my password for the agent, and it gets tapped somehow because they're using a cordless phone with analog cordless phone or analog cell phone. And we sniff that over RF or we tap their wire or whatever. And we acquire that password through not having root access to that box. We could still, if we just did password authentication, we could still log into that agent and we could still control it. But by doing this hash compliance, we assume that the attacker knows the IP addresses that are configured as the clients. If the hacker has no knowledge, no prior knowledge of the client IP addresses, and now of course we can just, we've got comments, we use pound for comments just like shell scripts, we can just throw in garbage into comments, which just obviously helps pump up the hash, so that if one client was assigned to IVD.conf and somehow that information got transmitted over a telephone, or by word of mouth across the cubicle farm, the password and knowledge of the IVD.conf or IV.conf, the actual client IP address, having one IP address in there alone and doing a SHA-1 is completely pointless since that could be replicated and both parts of that authentication could be broken. Our sensors are obviously running in promiscuous mode. Since we're already root, we might as well be running in promiscuous mode with filtering. We use a standard PCAP for this filter. And we're filtering by what's set up in the configuration file. So what we have are stateful user-defined connection filters, which are delegated as intrastate or defined as intrastate traffic. And we have stateless. It's actually really not stateless. It's minimal state. We keep track of the source, destination IP addresses, and the ports if applicable by protocol. And that's stored in an extrastate table. The agent is a PCAP filter, again. It stores the agent IP addresses plus a set of local exclusion ports. And what we mean by that is we want to be able to set up an agent that can run on a web server that's already communicating with the outside world. So if we want to set up an agent on a web server, we don't want to be sniffing traffic that is legitimately inbound for that web server. We're not developing an IDS. There are other tools to do that. We want to maintain, we want to maintain state on packets that are unexpected, coming to the same node that the agent's running on. And we want to do information gathering across these, the ones that are not exempted, we want to do information gathering of. We have intrastate. We reached the definitions. This is the scope of user-injected response. The table is based off splay trees. After talking with Marty about splay trees and also talking with Dan Hartmeyer, currently OpenBSD PF uses AVL trees with a single rotation. We've discussed possibly dumping splay trees in here. Why? When we get to the definitions of trees, you'll find that splay trees more adhere to the way that packets move across the wire, that we can actually simulate caching by bringing each expected node up to root, rather than having to have each node of a tree be maintaining height balanced of plus or minus one to maintain a nice balanced tree. We use layer three for this, obviously, because we can't anticipate necessarily that all our packets are arriving through data link on the local LAN. And we sort the splay tree by source IP addresses. So incoming packets, source IP addresses, because all, obviously the destination IP address will always be one that is being either one of the other agent IPs or the local agent IP that the promiscuous filter is running on or the promiscuous sniff is running on. And, we also maintain a local state of the routing table. Here we start dipping our first finger into why we're marrying this to a particular operating system and are not just using any operating system. We would only be able to actually maintain user-defined or slash etsy host slash etsyresolve.conf. We would only be able to use very, very clearly Unix-compliant files that are used across all operating systems. As you can tell, I'm a big Linux fan. We have Linux. TCP/IP headers have been rewritten various ways to make them completely incompatible with at low level. And so we have tools out there. The reason we have tools out there like LibNet and LibMUA, which ZSH is making as a component that is like LibNet, an alternative to LibNet, We have libevent, which is a open, well, it's basically a abstracted KQ method so that other operating systems like Linux that don't implement KQs can use tools that, like Niels Provost has come up with, Vomit, which actually sniffs. I don't know if you guys have seen this. It's worth checking out. Vomit actually is a sniffer that will basically reassemble WAV files of voice over IP connections, since Cisco chose not to encrypt these connections. We have intrastate rules. These are the rules, the static rules. Once the traffic makes it through the initial packet filter, the PCAP filter, the agent IP addresses, and the local exclusion or local exempted ports, we have a set of rules that go beyond that, that are statically defined to define what intrastate is and what extrastate is. The packet must have a local agent destination IP address. The packet also must have a protocol match. So we have a little bit mask, a little U-short type that keeps track of the protocols that are already current in the intrastate table. The protocols that are already been either user-defined injections or following a user-defined injection through continual injection after the user has made the initial SYN packet, we have a flow that goes back and forth across the agent that is supposedly or hopefully automated, that this matches up with the protocol that's already a part of the intrastate table so that we are not actually getting a protocol thrown on the wire that is not indicative of something that has not already been a part of the intrastate engine. Part of the reason for this is we don't want a hacker crafting packets, again, that can saturate our table, make it a mess to sort. If a good example is there are certain tools out there that do, without naming names, that do passive OS identification fingerprinting. And they use hash tables. We chose not to use hash tables because hash tables are inherently vulnerable. Why are they vulnerable? Well, if a hacker knows, I should say attacker, hackers aren't all bad. If an attacker knows that what to inject on the wire to produce state, the hacker can fill up that hash table. Early days of a particular tool I'm thinking of used a hash table, the currently publicly available one, uses a hash table size 10,000. If I inject a whole bunch of packets from random IP addresses to fill up that 10,000, that passive OS fingerprinting no longer happens because there isn't a mechanism that was implicit in that code that would actually do a copy of the old hash table into a bigger hash table, which is a mess on the big O. Everybody knows big O notation. And it takes big O of N, and if you've got 10,000, that's a hell of a lot of time to recopy that hash table. So we wanted to use in display trees or trees to keep a pointer-based reference that we can continually expand until we exhaust available resources, which we're marrying up because we're using OpenBSD as an operating system of choice. We've got a few areas of APIs that we can use, that such as pool_*. And the pool resources are a kernel resource pool manager, which basically allows the ability for an application to not drop like a rock when the box is hammered and the kernel's having enough difficulty trying to keep up. So we do other things. We do packet prediction, all this will become very apparent and is discussed in extreme detail in the white paper. Packet prediction is the core component of the expert system. We have injection state. We're doing stateful packet injection, so we want to make sure that if the user says, I want to inject a SYN to port 80 of this host, that is a part of the injection state, and that when the next packet is coming back in, we marry that up with the expert system's relative value changes, and we know that that's a valid packet and it's not a spoof packet. And we check this against the expert system tables, which the inference engine uses against the knowledge base for lookup. Extrastate is the information gathering component. Layer 3, layer 2 is assumed. Layer 3 conducts. It's also on a display tree. It keeps minimal state. We have a link list that keeps track of IP MAC address relationships on the local LAN for later purposes of doing either attack or defensive-based research using these packet anomalies that you'll see coming up later. The extra state rules are that we have a local agent destination with an unknown protocol. We have a local agent destination, or we have a local agent destination with an unknown source IP address. We have a remote agent destination, strategic placement. So if you set your agents up on two different sides of a LAN where you may predict that attacks may be coming from, you can guarantee that one of those agents is going to be on the same network segment as the attacker, which means that we can do some sort of stateful analysis from that agent. And with a minimal state, we can keep track of it with the other remote agents. And it also keeps track of layer 2 and layer 3 broadcast. TCP IP header versus MTU. This is going to get into why we are handling TCP fragment reassembly cheaply. The largest packet I've seen on a wire, you know, sending out numerous packets with Nemesis and other tools, is a TCP SYN and a SYN-ACK, which sends out 64 bytes because of a 25-byte set of TCP options. Then we have ARP that follows 28 bytes. The RIP base for extended RIP options is 24 bytes, and an OSPF hello packet is 24 bytes. That's kind of like the top four of the protocols that are already used in Nemesis as to the max values I've seen on the network wire. So what happens if we get a packet that's sent to us that is less than 64 bytes in length and we don't have a full header? Well, the minimal MTU I've seen is 572, which is indicative of PPP. I have never seen an MTU that has gone below 64 bytes. So the best way that we can handle TCP fragment handling is to simply drop the first frag if the full protocol header is not contained, because we're filtering based on this protocol header. Otherwise, we just filter on the first fragment only. Whereas Darren Reed's IPF, it keeps frags. Why? I'm not really sure. If we don't have a first frag combination and we let the other frags pass through, we don't have a first frag to match up with the rest of the fragments when doing reassembly. Therefore, we don't have a full attack taking place. The header's missing, or part of the header's missing. So the packets get dropped. So why do we keep frags? I've been talking with Dan about this a number of times, Dan Hartmeyer, the guy from PF. And we haven't been able to come up with real legitimate reasons for doing this. Now, I can understand doing this for IDS purposes because we're trying to match up protocol anomalous attacks, exploitation, fingerprinting. We're trying to match this up with signatures. So we want to make sure that we get the full header along with the payloads so that we can actually assign this to rules. And we have some sort of a knowledge as to what the hacker is doing rather than just a bunch of random packets going over the wire, which doesn't do anybody any good and creates a lot of hell going through a TCP dump. Otherwise, we filter the first fragment only, complete header, and the next packet injection depends only on the header. So, again, we don't care about the payload. If we're only caring about the next header or the complete header, we can just drop all the packets. And obviously, there are many reasons for doing fragmentation. A classical example is IP over IP tunneling. Increases the size. Our MTU is set to... set to Ethernet. We got 1,500 bytes on an Ethernet. And with IEEE, different header combinations, we have 1,492. An IP over IP tunnel would drag that size up to where it would be greater than the Ethernet MTU. So we'd have fragmentation across all these packets. Now, of course, this would be better handled if we did even distribution and we understood ahead of time that we're doing IP over IP tunneling so that we could bump the MTU up and make sure that we were having needless fragmenting, because this can produce twice the cost doing fragmenting on each packet. So our possible performance increase and decrease is based on this MTU. And then, of course, hackers fragment these packets, either very large, oversized packets or very small, usually typically, for denial of service, evasion, or compromise. We have our state tables, our interstate table. The updates are consist of addition and deletion. We have rapid deletion. This is why we don't use hash tables. It's an expensive cost to have to keep updating a table and deleting entries from it. It's just easier to make a prime hash table and to use linear probing, quadratic probing. There's all types of methods that you can use for trying to avoid collisions in hash tables. Frequent use. It's a very expensive operation. This is the most expensive operation, is keeping state on this table. So we need an optimal data structure. We need an extra state table, which just updates consistent on addition. And we'll remove the stuff over a timeout. I mean, there's really no reason to just keep removing stuff over and over and over and over again, like we've done with the interstate, because we're only trying to keep track of the current packet that's on the wire so that we can inject the next packet out. We don't want to have to sort protocol-dependent fields so that we can figure out which packet was the latest packet that was sent over the wire. That's just too much information to keep track of. Oh, which sequence number is the latest sequence number? It's a mess. So we're doing updates with the interstate table with rapid addition and rapid deletion. How's my time here? All right, speed is important, but not at the expense of security. Hash tables versus search trees. Well, why we don't use hash tables and why we use search trees. Hash tables can create, destroy, insert, delete, and find. We have a static array, and it's expensive to resize, as talked before. Our worst case is big O of log n. Our average case is big O of 1 if we don't have collisions. We do collision handling by giving that prime hash table size. We do up-end addressing and chaining. You can read up on hash tables if you're really interested in this. This is better if we're doing things like, I don't know, some symbol tables, like when you're compiling something, things where you're not going to be like removing things as you compile because you want to maintain state on those symbols. It's better if you just have additions and you don't have deletions. Our search trees can also create, destroy, insert, delete, and find. And a typical search tree is height balanced at each node. This can be an expensive operation if your hash table or if your search tree is very big. Balance is maintained through rotations. AVL trees are commonly defined as single and double rotations, which are commonly called zigzag, zag-zig, zig-zig, and zag-zag. OpenBSD PF implements solely single rotations at the moment, but we're still filling out. This is still early in the development of it, but hopefully everything will be in place and we'll actually have all the state tables solidified for PF by OpenBSD 3.0 this December. We have a linked structure representation rather than a static array that we've defined for a hash table, so our resize is just adding more pointers. Our worst case is big O of log n on a height balanced tree. We decided to use splay trees over AVL trees after many discussions. I'm pretty aware that Dragos, I'm not sure if he actually implemented the code. I know he was involved with it, according to Dan. Marty Royce, who just left at 1 o'clock today, unfortunately, could probably confirm that. But splay trees are used all over the place in Snort. They can perform faster operations than AVL trees, given a good splaying algorithm. They're self-adjusting binary trees. There's no height data stored, unlike AVL, so we get faster searches. But we rotate each access to root. So basically, the reason this works better for TCP/IP is if we were doing intrastate analysis of a packet, we have source IP to destination IP and vice versa, going back and forth over and over and over and over again. If we, on the first rotation or into the splay tree, we bump that value up to root of the tree. We have a big O of 1 worst case scenario for each additional packet that comes across the wire until we get a packet that is going to get rotated intrastate because the user is defining that he wants to send a packet to an HTTP server and then another packet to an SMTP server on yet another box. As these stagger back and forth, we obviously are going to have probably a worse cost of about the cost of an AVL tree. If anybody can argue that point with me later, that'd be great. I'd really like to hear that AVL works better than splay, but so far I'm not convinced. The amortized retrieval is big O of log N on average. Our worst case is a tree that kind of pretty much looks like, if I'm drawing this backwards, straight line that goes across, it's all in order. By definition, a splay tree will never be big O of log, or big O of N for more than one insert into the splay tree. We bump that up to root, we have a little bit more balance and things are happy. We have our splay tree algorithm, which does double rotations and does this zigzag, which the zig is indicative of a left branch and a zag is indicative of a right branch. This is also expressed in more detail in the white paper. Expert systems. We have an unbiased, maximum performance, lacks personality. Mycin, which is probably the first commercial expert system, mapped bacterial infections and how doctors could basically take a look at symptoms that a particular patient has across a number of bacteria and to try to pinpoint this to what might be the cause of this person's illness. Obviously, anybody in this room, everybody's got their proficiency. Some people are Linux kernel coders. Some people are Linux user land coders. Some people are Windows people. Everybody's got a proficiency, but if you have an expert system that is matched to, like in Mycin's case, that is mapped against all known bacteria infection types, we can deduce what the plausible bacteria types are with human intervention to make sure that we have a possible match so we don't give someone the wrong prescription or something. Knowledge bases. We have a TCP/IP rule base, an attack rule base, a defense rule base. TCP/IP rule base is the most important. It is indicative of a dictionary. Dictionary of protocols by major and minor version with the respective dependent fields that need to be altered to maintain this next packet injection. And again, we have inference engines that match up to these knowledge bases. The inference engines pretty much tell how to sort the knowledge bases in as little time as possible. Our TCP/IP rule base consists of a list of rules by protocol. We inject a TCP SYN across destination port 80. So we make an injection table addition. We sniff the next incoming TCP SYN ACK packet. We reverse the injection state match, so we invert the source with the destination IP address and the ports, and we say, hey, that was already injected by the user, so this must be a valid sniff. We add that to the interstate table, and the rules represent the minimal state change, connection integrity. Here's an example. We have a packet prediction. We have a SYN ACK going to an ACK. So we sniff the SYN ACK. We want to send out an ACK as the next packet. We sniff an ACK number of the incoming packet, and we make that the new sequence number of the outgoing packet. We sniff the sequence number of the incoming packet, and we make that the ACK number plus one of the outgoing packet. Hence, we keep the connection going through raw sockets. We add a payload. This makes clear text protocols really easy. You got Unicode, and you've got all these other little attacks that, you know, you always see these people running them against your Unix boxes, you know, like they did any sort of information gathering. You can do head/HTTP. You could just dump this into a file, and if you're maintaining this packet prediction, next packet injection, you pull the next file from the payload file, and boom, you've got a head, you've done a stateful connection back and forth, three-way handshake, and you've actually simulated doing information gathering through head using raw sockets alone with no client-server-based connection through standard networking sockets, like BSD sockets, and et cetera. Exploitation. Here's a famous one. And IDS evasion. We can use this, and we can actually use this to map the directory structure. All we have to do is change the payload at the end of here, and we can actually walk a file system and just have it dump all the packet payload that's coming back on the wire to a file. I mean, really, the goal here is not to have the agent take over the human's interaction. It's just to help out with the information gathering so that the human isn't doing all these esoteric moves. When you go do a network penetration test, all right, I got to do a ping scan. All right, I got to do a port scan. I mean, all this is just so humdrum that it would be nice if we could actually automate some of these attacks and just bring the information that we want back. I mean, after all, we're assessing the organization for economic risk and not necessarily assessing an organization for the exploit of the day, for Solaris. We've got bouncing and stealth. We can connect to a proxy and we can send tool, you know, payload after we've made this connection. And we can basically masquerade our IP address. Our attack roles, we're going to go through this real quick because these are stubs right now. They maintain exploitation signatures and denial of service signatures. All these are taking the TCP rule base. The reason why these are stubs right now is we need a rule-based language for maintaining packets and their dependent protocol values. What we mean by that is we need a way that we can say, okay, we want to send out this packet, and then this packet with these fields, then the next packet, and that's indicative of yada yada denial of service attack. So we do this at the protocol layer. We aren't calling it SMURF. We aren't calling it JP. We aren't calling it other names for denial of service attacks. But the idea here is that we don't want to make a network attack engine that can only do one thing. We want to make a packet crafter that can launch a whole bunch of these attacks given the knowledge in the rule base through the inference engine lookups of how we can actually launch each one of these attacks and define them by individual packets that get sent across the wire. I mean, keep in mind that we have full control over the protocol headers by not using standard networking I.O., so we can pretty much do anything here. The defensive rule base, the reason we're keeping this to OpenBSD, we want to marry this up with OpenBSD PF through I.O. control. Wouldn't it be cool if you had an agent on a multi-tiered host and you, as a user connecting to these agents, knew that these multi-homed hosts were connected to two different peers across two different interfaces, two different ISP peers, let's say, or upstream. And attacks started coming in through a particular interface, and then we could automatically drop that attack by dynamically adding a firewall rule to restrict any, or dynamically adding a route, a black hole route, that would drop all those packets on the wire until somebody got a chance to come and assess the damage that was happening on the network. I mean, if nobody's getting to the server anyway because of a denial of service attack, we might as well keep the stuff from flooding the network. Because if you've got IDS sensors deployed across your network, and you're doing information gathering based on your topology, just like every good speaker has told you so far, you are actually collecting a ton of state that keeps coming in, banging your boxes. You keep getting sensors probing, or you keep getting sensor alerts that will keep going until somebody responds. And it'd be nice if we could keep the rest of the information gathering on the network sane and that we only detected it once and we just say that it's maintaining this until somebody can get to the box to figure out what's going on and do some data forensics analysis. So we marry this up with both OpenBSD PF and the routing tables. We have a TCP IP engine, attack engine, and defense engine. We do deterministic prediction, predict with certainty. There are many ways of doing inference engines. There are pretty much three ways. There's forward chaining, backward chaining, and rule value. Rule value is a optimized version of backward chaining. And basically forward chaining is a data-driven search. Backward chaining is a goal-driven search. We want to predict with certainty across the TCP IP rule-based and inference engine. We don't want to send the next packet if we don't know exactly what we want to send next. We don't want to hose the interstate connections. That's the whole goal here. If we can't maintain because we're missing, we've got three unknowns and we can't decide what two of the unknowns are going to have to map to, we just drop the packet. TCP is very forgiving. If you don't respond and there's already a handshake going, it'll gladly send you another packet and tell you more about what it needs. We do probabilistic prediction for the attack and defense. We predict with uncertainty. This is mostly used for user-defined injection. Want to do a SMURF attack, send it across the wire. So we remove greatest uncertainty, minimal cost. Oops. Major protocol, TCP, ICMP. Minor protocol, TCP, SYNAC, ICMP redirect. Rule value means that we remove the greatest uncertainty at a minimal cost. So if the next packet that comes across the wire is a TCP packet, we can instantly narrow the scope down to the knowledge base to just TCP packets. And then we can, again, based on the TCP flags that come across the wire, we can narrow that down to an even finer grain scope of what the minor protocol is. So we go, now we're only looking at what the next relative injections are for a particular event of TCP. So we have protocol connection dependent relative field values. Add plus one to this field. Set this to a default value. We just grab the minimal state required to make the next connection out. We have actually what, for most packets and in my research of gluing various pieces of code together, it's a constant value. It's like big O 3, big O 4. We usually need to change about 3 or 4 values to keep a protocol or to keep a connection moving. User-defined injection. Can anybody read that? User-defined injection, only way to have intrastate. We aren't allowing any packets to move across the wire that are brought in through the PCAP filter and through the intrastate, extrastate, static rule base without the user injecting the packet first. So we inject and we add to the table. And then we have automated injection, which injects the next packet if the criteria is met. We have stateful packet injection. The usage is sensor sniffs the packets. Intrastate checks the reverses of the addresses and the ports. Checks injection table. Present, we send to the expert system. If it's not present, we update the extra state and we drop the packet, or we drop state. So we want to drop all that state we've been keeping on the packet and move it into extra state if it's not important to what the user has already defined as what they want to do across the wire. Thank you very much. This is the actual key to unlock the white paper that I will upload to the site later. I did this just to give you guys a little value-added flavor. And I've had, like, all these people on IRC, like, are you going to release the paper early? No, but if you attended the conference, which a lot of you did, cognitive science is the key, and it will be mapped to that key, and that should encrypt it and decrypt it. And that's it. Does anybody have any questions? I know you have a lot, but this white paper will clear up a lot. Is it game? The presentation wasn't, but what did you mean by case sensitive? Oh, yeah, it is case sensitive. Yes. www.packetninja.net. You'll find both Nemesis and you'll find Intravenous. I kind of pulled off all the kiddie code that I used to write off the site. I'm trying to get more deeper into OpenBSD. I currently maintain about 15 ports for OpenBSD, and I want to start delving more into the kernel. And this is kind of I'm providing this for OpenBSD for reasons that will be outlaid on the white paper as being very sane reasons for making this choice. But I'll admit to you all right now that I'm being a little selfish and that I want to be able to research the OpenBSD kernel at a more intricate level at the same time I'm producing the intelligent agent. Anything else? Thank you very much for attending.